Chapter 24. The bishop could stay in Iceland only a few days. He said, "God be with you," to Theobrand. Then, hoping he would prove stanch, sailed to other ports and other priests, and presently to other kings. Theobrand's only comfort lay in that wish that God would be with him, for he now found himself in the deepest spiritual crisis of his life. His tragedy was that when he had become a priest, he had not ceased to be a man. Now that it was no longer possible for him to be both, they warred desperately within him to see which would at last kill the other. Whatever he was as a man, he was an honest priest, and as such he fervently wanted to live up to his bishop's adjuration and be a rock of the faith. For that, he knew he would doubtless get his throat cut, since the Bonders were already leaping back into Odin's lap. Neither persuasion nor reasoning would move them now. His best argument always had been Olaf's armed might, as theirs was now Earl Eric's. If he met them, it could only be in battle, for which he must rally such true believers as he could find. But there he stopped. None but slaves would be his allies. He still was heathen enough to face death in a good sword fight, but not Christian enough to trust a slave. He misjudged them, as the Sea King had, as any master must misjudge a slave. It was beyond the reach of his mind to know that this time they would have been true. They would have fought. They might have won and held the island for Christ. As he counted his several chances upon his beads, he could see only that he would be alone and betrayed, hunted through swamp and forest as Olaf once had been, as Olaf had later hunted Hakon, as Hakon's son would hunt him now. One course lay open, but he did not want to see it, and marked off all the others first. "I might try this stratagem, or this, or this," he mused, knowing that none of them would work, and then, trapped by his own logic, let himself come to it. "I might once more be a holy hermit, somewhere far away and unknown, amid simple fisherfolk. They would value my wisdom and bring food to my cave." Ah, no, he could not go back to that. He had sometimes thought wistfully of it, but he knew he had come too far, had changed too much and been bitten too deeply by success, ever again to be the simple soul he was. If he were now to sit in a damp, chilly cleft in a rock, he would have no holy thoughts there, but would listen always for echoes from across the ocean, waiting crazily for a second miracle and a second Olaf. He looked about at the grandeur of the Sea King's hall. Then his bead slipped through its fingers to the floor, and his tears followed them. With hands clasped downward, for he could not face the sky, he prayed. It was his last prayer, and in it, he made a choice of the way he would take. It was none of the ways he had examined in his beads, but another still. To be such a man as he really was, as honestly as he could. His God was no mere concept to him, but very real, seated on a real throne, on a real golden floor above the sky. So he tried earnestly to explain the choice he was making and why, and where he thought the blame lay. "Lord, I can be your priest no longer. I have failed you. In my cave, I meant to serve you, and the glory of your presence was as sunlight in my dark retreat. But you caused me to leave my cave and learn what life could be outside it. I have tasted fine food and drink, and I wear this splendid cloak about my shoulders and this golden circlet on my head. Forgive me, Lord, and pity me. I can never again do without these things, for the hermit of the cave is dead, and the king's ambassador is sitting in his skin. Here I will stay as long as I am able, come what will. Goodbye, dear Lord. Amen. He exhaled deeply, and all of him that had been sanctified seemed to float away on his breath, leaving its human husk behind. He felt curiously empty, needing something to fill the unaccustomed gap within him. There was nothing at hand for this but wine. Bishop Sigurd had suggested, in kindness, that he take a little of it. That little soon grew into a great deal. But there was no more help for the man than for the priest. His personal woes pressed in upon him. He needed some way to get rid of his debts, and if possible, his family. His prestige was gone beyond regaining. The Bonders would not trust him, even if he offered to join them. They'd had too much old hatred for him. His head would be carried to Earl Eric as proof of their new loyalty. Nothing was left but his solitary magnificence and his wine. For many days after the bishop left, Theobrand did not stir out of doors. He ordered the fire and the torches replenished and sat in the great guest hall, dressed in his finery, imagining as he grew drunker that Olaf still lived. Despite himself, he had an ally, Helga. She broke in upon one of his sodden dreams and offered him her help. Her eyes were swollen from weeping over what had happened at Svold and how it hurt Theobrand's fortunes, but she had put her grief behind her and roused herself, out of and above her habitual meekness, to the point where she wanted to do battle. She tried to awaken him to action, to the fighting spirit she'd first seen and admired in him, when he outfaced the Bonders at her husband's feast. "You must stand against them all," she exhorted. "You must preach the word." She was back in that night, forgetting what had happened since. Theobrand turned his reddened eyes toward her and almost groaned. He ached with tiredness from being pulled in many directions by king, bishop, Bonders, God, and himself. Now she had come too to help pluck him apart. "The battle is lost," he said sullenly. "I can do nothing alone. Let me be in peace." "What are their numbers?" she cried, "against the fire of your speech. You will make them see the truth. You will shame them." As he looked at her, through the drunken haze with which he was surrounding himself, he began to hate her afresh and see plots where there were none. "You were eager to get me killed," he said, narrowing his eyes slyly. She put that down to his drunkenness and tried to encourage him, declaring that she would stand beside him and if they died, it would be together. Theobrand shook his head stubbornly. "I shall die soon enough," he said, "with or without you. When your husband hears the news of Svold, he will come back. You are my husband." "That is easily remedied," Theobrand sneered. "You cast off husbands as a snake does its skin." "I love you," she answered, holding back her tears. This irritated him. It was true, and she was putting him unbearably in the wrong. To meet that, he made himself more sarcastic and churlish. "You will make his homecoming very pleasant. You will hand over to him everything he once owned, his house, his hall, his farm, his son, and the trinkets and ornaments I have added as well, if he is willing to pay for them. You have been a faithful guardian for him. He may even be glad to have you back, with his other possessions. You seem very desirable to a man who has been without a woman a long time." She began shrinking back into her meek self. "I know you are tired of me," she said sadly. tired of you. If I'd never met you, I might have married Olaf's foster sister. But Olaf is dead. I know it, he screamed, and you take pleasure in reminding me of it. That is not true, she protested meekly. Don't speak to me of truth, he shouted with his rage now in full sail. I know the truth. I've preached it, and I've heard it, and I know it at sight. Every move you make is to remind me of what I want to forget, of what I might have been but for you. You are filled with triumph now you have made me no better than yourself. What a fine, sly trick you and your father played on me. You foresaw that Olaf meant me to rule Iceland, and that I would have my choice of women from among the noble, the beautiful, yes, and the young. You schemed and plotted and called me your guest, and made haste to tie me to you. To this mixture of partial truth and enraged distortion, Helga could only oppose the single truth on which she leaned. But I love you, and could not understand why he did not see the immense difference that made. Do not think, he rushed on, that you were the first woman I had seen or could get. There were many who used to come to my cave, beautiful women, more beautiful than you ever were. They would place their hands in mine for comfort and ask my counsel, though never once did my soul yield to my body. I was strong then, before I knew you, before you destroyed me. I was a man of God. But you still are, cried Helga, bewildered. And you must speak for God now. Speak for God, speak for God, speak for God, he jeered, mimicking her tone. Why must I speak for God? Someone must, in a moment like this, in such an hour of trial. If even a single voice is raised, why not your own, since you are so zealous? Who would listen to me? I am no one. You are too modest. Have you forgotten? You are a saint. He roared with laughter at that great joke of his. You once did call me that, said Helga gravely. And because you said it, and because I love you, I promise you that if your lips are silenced, I will speak. I will say the splendid things you have said to me. I will carry them in my heart. I will remember. But while you are able, you who have a gift of words... Theobrand turned from her with a contemptuous grunt and began drinking again. He drank a huge draught, much more than he wanted, because he knew she would be distressed to see him befuddling himself now. It was a relief to hide his face behind the big two-handled cup and not have to meet her hateful, righteous eyes. He wished he had succeeded in keeping his rage at a high pitch. He would like to have thrown the wine in her face. There was no way of getting around to it now. Helga saw his fingers tighten around the cup as he refilled it, and his look of hate gave her some sort of idea of what he was thinking. Then his face was hidden again by the cup as he tilted back his head to drain it. When he took it away, she was gone. Before Helga fell in love with Theobrand, she had never felt very deeply about anything. That was fortunate for her in such rapidly changing times, for she was thus able to throw away one idea and receive another with little discomfort. But when this man, whom she thought truth itself, had called her a saint, her heart seized upon it. Absurd though it had seemed to him as he said it, to her it became a simple, sacred fact, to be believed humbly and without vanity, and of which she must always be worthy. Even now, as she left him swilling in the guest hall, she had the memory of that exalted moment when, though he meant it for deceit, he had brought a purpose into her life.